Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Medicare and Hospital Reimbursement Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 4, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Sebelius v. Auburn Regional Medical Center. This case involves Medicare payments to hospitals. The issue is whether a 180-day statutory limit for filing an appeal with the Provider Reimbursement Review Board from a final Medicare payment determination is subject to equitable tolling, meaning that a court has power to delay the ruling of the time limit in the interests of fairness. To discuss the case, we have Evan Young, who is a senior associate at Baker Botts, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. Mr. Young also speaks on his own behalf and not on behalf of Baker Botts. And now, Mr. Young.
Medicare accounting practices. The jurisdictional reach of an entity called the Provider Reimbursement Review Board, equitable tolling in administrative agencies. Those don't sound like the ingredients for a fascinating debate among three outstanding advocates and the justices of the Supreme Court, but they were in the argument in Sebelius v. Auburn Regional Medical Center on December 4th. This case is ostensibly about Medicare, but it is actually about a border dispute, not geographical borders, but something just as important, at least from the perspective of litigants and courts. The dispute here lies in the murky borderlands between jurisdictional statutory provisions and statutory provisions that are merely claim processing rules. The Supreme Court has been trying for years to draw the true line between those realms. This case may help. Here's the basic storyline. The respondents are hospitals who claim that they were underpaid by the government for the Medicare services they provided, especially to low-income beneficiaries. This is no small matter because Medicare transfers billions and billions of dollars a year to providers. The Medicare accounting process is extraordinarily complex. Suffice it to say that the hospitals were counting on the government to aggregate huge amounts of data, which would determine how much each hospital should receive. Much of the data were off-limits to the hospitals, so they depended upon accurate government calculation. The hospitals in this case allege that the underpayment was fraudulent and intentional, that the government purposefully cooked the books to write smaller checks. The hospitals say that this was not just an error, but was government misconduct, and they claim that they were only able to discover this misconduct because it came to light in an unrelated lawsuit. Let's pause and consider these rather serious allegations. The Supreme Court will assume that they are true because the case arose from a motion to dismiss. That means that if the hospitals win in the Supreme Court case, all they win is the right to then go back and make their case. So it's hard to say at this point whether the flamboyant claims of governmental misconduct are correct or not, but it does seem that these hospitals were underpaid and that they honestly could not have discovered the underpayment earlier. Indeed, at the argument, Deputy Solicitor General Needler acknowledged that sometimes a provider may simply be unable to figure out the underpayment.
There may be situations in which the provider would not know that. The need for finality under this program, we think, requires an across-the-board rule.
Against that background, consider the claims in this case. The hospital filed them in 2006, seeking recovery for the years between 1987 and 1994. Even the most recent of their claims, in other words, was 12 years old, far more than the apparent absolute limit of 3 years. And when they brought the claims to the board dismissed them for precisely that reason. No matter how good the excuse, the board said it had no power at all to toll the limitations period. That was that. The hospitals then filed suit in district court. They argued there, and still argue, that the 180-day period in the statute is merely a claim processing rule, not a jurisdictional limit, and that the hospitals, therefore, have the right to prove their entitlement to equitable tolling. If the government knowingly withheld crucial information so that no amount of diligence on the part of the hospitals would have led them to know that they were being shorted, then, according to the hospitals, those claims were tolled. Tolling is available unless Congress provides otherwise, and one way that Congress provides otherwise is by enacting a jurisdictional limit. And so the district court had to decide first if the statute was in fact jurisdictional, and if it was not, the district court had to decide if equitable tolling was available to the hospitals. The district court ruled against the hospitals. It agreed that the board had no discretion to toll the claims. Among several other reasons that the court had for concluding that tolling was not available, The court found that the statutory scheme was so complex and comprehensive as to leave no room for further judicial tinkering in the form of adjusting the time limits Congress imposed. But the D.C. Circuit disagreed. It noted the presumption favoring the availability of equitable tolling. And unlike the district court, it found the statutory scheme not that complex. Yes, the Medicare Act itself is tediously complex, but all that matters is that the timing requirements for reimbursement challenges are simple and similar to timing provisions of many other statutes in which equitable tolling has been found. The Supreme Court granted cert because the circuits had split on this issue and, given the amounts at stake and the underlying issue of jurisdiction versus claims processing rules, it's a big deal. The court also appointed Professor John Manning as amicus curiae in support of the position that the 180-day limit was jurisdictional and incapable of extension. This is an unusual appointment that adds to why this case is interesting. More commonly, the court will appoint an amicus to brief and argue a case when the petitioner and respondent end up agreeing with each other. When that happens, usually with the Solicitor General confessing error, it means that unless the court appoints someone new, no one would be left to defend the judgment under review. That's not the situation in this case. Here, the government and the hospitals do not agree about the result, but a third advocate was still necessary because otherwise, nobody would argue that the statutory 180 days was a jurisdictional limit that could not be extended even by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So in short, here are the three positions. First, the government, which says that the time limit is jurisdictional in the sense that courts may not toll it, but it also says that the Secretary has discretion to make exceptions. Second, the amicus, Professor Manning, says that the time limit is jurisdictional, period, and that means that neither the courts nor the Secretary may make exceptions beyond the 180 days mentioned in the statute. Finally, the hospitals say that the statute is not jurisdictional at all. And so let's turn to the argument before the Supreme Court. First, is thinking about this case as jurisdiction versus claim processing even the right question? The real issue in this case is equitable tolling. Thinking about the border between jurisdiction and claim processing rules makes sense because we know that tolling is only available if the statutory time limit is not jurisdictional. Or is it? One amicus brief, not Professor Manning's, argued that this was a false dichotomy and that the jurisdictional label is not dispositive or even helpful. But that amicus apparently means that some other statutory provision might permit tolling. That, however, is not really the point. During the argument, Justice Scalia responded to a variant of this argument.
If there's another statutory provision, then that statutory extension is part of the jurisdictional limitation. That's fine.
In other words, it isn't really equitable tolling if the statute specifically calls for it. And if there is no statutory basis for mitigating the effects, then there can be no equitable tolling of a limitations period, period. So if this statute, which does not contain any mitigating language, turns out to be jurisdictional, it truly is the end of the debate and the end of the road for the hospitals. It doesn't mean that the hospitals win if it is not jurisdictional, but it means they lose if it is. So, is it jurisdictional? Let's start with Professor Manning, who was appointed to take the uber-jurisdictional approach. Professor Manning looks primarily to statutory structure. The provision at issue, he points out, is in the statutory text that actually creates the board and identifies how the board may have power to act. What could be more jurisdictional than that, he asks. Moreover, Professor Manning emphasized that Congress is perfectly capable of allowing greater flexibility. Not only has it done so in many other statutes, but it even did so in the very Medicare Act that is at issue, where it distinguished between sophisticated providers and ordinary beneficiaries. Here's Professor Manning.
And so in the same statute, what Congress did was it set up two systems, one for beneficiaries and one for providers. One prescribed discretion, one didn't. What the respondents are asking this court to do is to read these two sets of provisions, which are worded very differently, to mean the same thing.
And how about the government? It's a bit more equivocal. It wants the statute to be jurisdictional from the perspective of courts, but not jurisdictional from the perspective of the executive branch. Does that make any sense? At oral argument, the very first comment from the bench was from Chief Justice Roberts, who identified the government's position as a seeming contradiction.
Mr. Kneedler, there's a little bit of, at least, facial incongruity in your position. Congress sets in place the 180-day limit, and you say, oh, that, we can go beyond that. The Secretary puts in the 3-year limit, and you say, that's it. you know, that's the dead drop-off. I would have thought what Congress says is entitled to greater weight than what the Secretary says.
If forced to choose, it seems that the government would ultimately prefer to go Professor Manning's route and sacrifice the Secretary's discretion than to lose on jurisdiction and risk equitable tolling by the courts. But it isn't conceding that it has to make such a choice. And the hospitals, well, they have their own textual argument. The relevant statute is phrased in terms of the providers being able to obtain review. It is not phrased in terms of the board's power to do something. This directly responds to Professor Manning's argument. Moreover, the hospitals correctly point out that filing deadlines are most usually called claim processing rules rather than jurisdictional limits, even if no magic words are required for something to be jurisdictional. Finally, the hospitals argue that equitable tolling is essential to the functioning of the statute. The whole point of the board is to give Medicare providers the ability to ensure accurate payments. This is Congress's wish, and the Secretary should not be able to unilaterally thwart that purpose by withholding data until it was too late to be of any use. In other words, if the statute depends upon equitable tolling, it cannot simultaneously impose a rigid jurisdictional bar. But what about the long history of this statute and this regulation by the Secretary? Does that indicate congressional acquiescence? The government's argument in defense of its position turns in part on the long history of the Secretary's good cause regulations. For 4 decades, the government has simultaneously characterized the statute as jurisdictional and permissive of its own ability to provide relief beyond the 180-day window. Congress has amended the Medicare Act many times over the past 4 decades, and it never has moved to get rid of the 3-year good cause provision. This history arguably shows congressional acquiescence, and Justice Ginsburg asked Professor Manning why that didn't defeat his argument that the statute is rigidly jurisdictional. His response was that there are any number of reasons why Congress may not have responded, but none of them can trump the statutory text.
Congress leaves regulations in place for all sorts of reasons, because of somebody's using a parliamentary tactic, because Congress doesn't have one opinion or the other about whether the regulation is right, because Congress didn't think of the problem. So in recent years, this Court has insisted upon a high degree of proof before it will find acquiescence, and that degree is not present here.
The hospitals agree that there has been legislative acquiescence. But they say that the government and Professor Manning get the import of that acquiescence backward. What Congress acquiesced to, the hospitals say, was the refusal to treat the 180 days mentioned in the statute as a hard and fast rule. What about, however, administrative discretion and Chevron? The government repeatedly and reasonably emphasized that we're talking about an administrative regime here, an administrative forum that is part of the Department of Health and Human Services. Doesn't that mean that under Chevron, the Secretary has wide discretion in implementing a complex regulatory statute? That is why the government thinks that judges cannot toll the limitations period, but that the Secretary can do so. The regulations are entitled to deference from courts and cannot be upset by judicial tinkering unless, of course, they are arbitrary and capricious. But the government says that nothing is arbitrary and capricious about a 3-year limit. It is more generous than it would reasonably have to be. Justice Breyer suggested that the government might be right.
The subject matter is a rather technical agency review board, and normally I would think, you would think, and members of Congress would think that the agency knows best as to how to run its own operation and don't interfere too much with details. And this is a sort of detail.
Professor Manning says that Chevron could apply in theory, but that it fails in practice under step one of the Chevron test because the statute is clearly jurisdictional. Congress has spoken to the question. And the hospitals argue that the Secretary is overstating her own importance. Congress did not simply provide for board review, but also for subsequent judicial review. The hospital's brief puts it this way: an agency cannot, through regulations, help itself out of the very review of its own actions that Congress ordered. Let's turn to the question of what happens if it ends up not being jurisdictional. How do the parties line up then? The government pointed out that it should win this case even if Professor Manning were right to claim that the government lacks authority to grant any extensions at all. That is because the board would have to be even more inflexible than the 3-year limit already is. The hospitals would lose whether the limit is hard and fast at 180 days or hard and fast at 3 years. In that sense, the government and the amicus, Professor Manning, reach the same result. But that is true only if the court finds that the filing deadlines are jurisdictional. If not, the government and Professor Manning part ways. Here's Professor Manning's very last comment at oral argument.
If the statute is not jurisdictional, it's subject to equitable tolling. Under Irwin, the presumption of equitable tolling applies, and it's very difficult to see how the Secretary is warranted in narrowing equitable tolling beyond the traditional grounds on which equitable tolling would be available.
In other words, Professor Manning would agree with the hospitals and not with the government if the justices conclude that the statute is not jurisdictional. So let's sum it all up. This is not an easy case, and it has a lot of moving parts. The fact that the court needed three lawyers, none of whom fully agreed with another, is some evidence of the complexity of the underlying issues. Each advocate had strong arguments for the interpretation that he preferred as well. The court has struggled with demarcating jurisdictional limits from mere claim processing rules. Some justices, like Justice Scalia, have been much quicker to find jurisdictional rules than others, like Justice Ginsburg. If they can find a principle that puts this tough case on one side of the line or the other, it may be of great use to courts and litigants far beyond the immediate Medicare context. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia. As always, The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Means.